It's 9:04 a.m. and we have first up today, well, let's see, first of all, it's March the 20th. Present for the record are Senators Bundy, Green, French, Stevens, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have got four items on the agenda today, and the first is the confirmation hearing for Lieutenant Governor Designee, and that's Talis Kohlberg. If you just come forward. Hey, Representative Meyer, come forward and tell us. My goodness, you're going to be doing everything in this administration by the time we're done, huh?
I would hope not. Thank you, Chairman McGuire and committee members. I am Talis Kohlberg. I've been before several confirmation meetings at this point for various things. And at to the extent that you wanted, I can give a brief, somewhat redundant summary of myself to those of you who haven't heard me before, or I can.
I'm okay with you just kind of getting to the new role that you're filling and how you see yourself filling that role. And we've been through the Attorney General qualification, so.
Okay, thank you, Chairman McGuire. The first of all, I don't plan to be filling this particular role. It would be only an event of unfortunate circumstance, although I have told the Lieutenant Governor repeatedly that I'm monitoring his health closely, and because he's younger than me, I think statistically he'll outlast me, but I do encourage him not to exercise and intake lots of cholesterol. I believe if necessary I could fulfill the roles of the duties of the Lieutenant Governor, review citizen initiatives, review citizen referendum, gavel the House and Senate into session until officers are chosen, file state regulations, commission notaries for the state, head the historical commission, and I would do my best to zealously serve as a custodian of the state seal. And I don't expect that particular set of duties to ever come my way, but I believe I could do them if I had to. So,
great questions. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, and this is a little bit from left field, but if in view of a very unlikely but potential role that you would serve as Lieutenant Governor, does that add to the discussion as to whether we should have an elected Attorney General or not?
I guess if you want my views on that, I've answered that question in a prior committee. Personally, if you had asked me 6 months ago, should the Attorney General be elected, I probably would have said that sounds reasonable to me. Under the general explanation that, from my point of view, anything that breaks up the concentration of power tends to, in the long run, serve people. And most of the states, 43 of them, do elect Attorney Generals, and they seem to function. On the flip side of it, it's been pointed out to me increasingly since I'm in the position I am right now that there are downsides to having elected attorney generals, which basically it sets up an opposition to legislative agendas, gubernatorial agendas that sometimes could work for the detriment of people if they were being used for political purposes. But the you would probably tend to have some more orientation towards an agenda that would be formed in the course of a campaign that would make people want to try to drive the staffing decisions on a political basis. But either way works, and whether the governor's choice of who is the successor to the lieutenant governor is not dictated to be this position. It does not have to be the attorney general. So If the question is, would it change this particular scenario today to have an elected attorney general, the governor could just as easily appoint the commissioner of something else, and then the question would not be answered at all unless you were going to elect all commissioners. So I don't think it would change the outcome of today materially. In fact, it would be less likely a governor would appoint an attorney general to a successor to a lieutenant governor if it was someone who had run an active campaign with issues diametrically opposed to the governor. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. If I might, I tend to agree with the arguments for not electing the Attorney General, for electing a, what's the official title, Lieutenant Governor Designee, that might be another issue, and we might, at some time, we have nothing else to explore the federal model, and where I believe it would be the Speaker of the House would be President
actually,
or a couple Governor Pro Tem.
I, through the chairman to Senator Bundy, I've actually encountered a couple of people who are somewhat surprised that, the governor mm-hmm. had the ability to designate the successor and had automatically assumed that there was something closer to the federal model in place.
Well, I'm just shocked and amazed that people aren't that well informed. I've been on that for now 2 minutes or three.
Further questions, Mr. Colbert? Okay. Senator Stevens.
I think it's about time a professor of history made it to this position. And
I love it.
Through the chair to Senator Stevens, it's always a pleasure to see you, sir.
Good answer in a confirmation hearing. Okay. Anybody else? Is there anybody here in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay. So I'll read the motion before us. In accordance with AS 3905080, the State Affairs Committee, Senate State Affairs Committee, reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Lieutenant Governor Designee Talis Colbert. This does not reflect any intent by any individual member to vote for or against the confirmation of this individual during further sessions. Is there an objection to that? So if not, we'll just go ahead and take a brief at ease to sign it. The next item on the agenda, which is our second hearing on Senate Bill number 92 by Senator French. Senator French.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. When we met last, we were discussing an amendment to the bill, or a proposed amendment to the bill, brought by Senator Bundy regarding the rural exemption that is contained in the bill. The idea is that the bill envisions the department setting out a few areas of the state where the ignition interlock requirement would not apply due to the low population and due to the unlikelihood that an ignition interlock would be available there. We learned last week that the folks who provide the service are willing to fly to communities when there's 2, 3, 4 DWI offenders there who need the service and that they would absorb the cost. But we went and ran a list that you should have underneath a cover letter from me or a little cover memorandum of where the DWIs in the state occur. Now, you'll notice there's lots of them that seem to come from outside Alaska, and that's really just the home residence of the person who was caught. But you'll also see many, many places in the state where there are, you know, 1 and 2 DWIs per annum. And just as an example, under the ends, if you look at Nikolaevsk, which had 2, Non-Dalton, which had 1, Norvik, which had 1, Nuiqsut, which had 1, and Nulato, which had 1, you can see there are many, many places in the state that have, you know, 1 DWI per year. And it's my concern that the requirement of an ignition interlock would essentially serve as a de facto disqualification of that person's ability to drive during the period of their probation. If that's what the body wants to do as a policy call, just simply ban people from driving during the period of the license revocation or the period of their probation, that's fine. But it still strikes me as being essentially unfair to do it to some people and not do it to others. So I guess my view is that the balanced approach taken by the bill is the one to strike, and that we can trust the department to apply it in a firm but even-handed way, and so that's the material that we've gathered for the committee to put before it in making the decision with respect to the amendment made by Senator Bundy.
Okay, so Senator Bundy.
A question, if I might, for Senator French. On the first page we've got, and help me with my ignorance, what are rug courts?
I'm sorry?
You have this first piece of information we have, and it says RUG courts, refused convictions, and DWI.
Oh, RUG, yep. Good question. Help from the...
here comes a rug court expert. Do you do carpet as well?
For the record, Doug Wooliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. Part of the record that I believe you must have came from the courts. We ran conviction data on various court locations. RUG courts are our old computer system. The other section is our new computer. It stands for Rural Users Group, but it's just the name of the computer system in those smaller court locations.
Senator Bundy.
I'm
surprised you didn't know that, Senator Bundy.
If I might, Madam Chair, and Senator French makes a cogent argument, I suppose we could make the opposite argument that no matter how small a community you live in, if the idea of the interlocking device is to protect the citizen from irresponsible drivers, they should get the same protection as someone who lives in Anchorage. But under the RUG courts, as long as Doug's here, if I might ask, these are the number of convictions for DWI in these various communities. Is that, have you seen a copy of this?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I gave a copy to Senator French's office. I neglected to keep one for myself, but I'm familiar with them. Those are the convictions for calendar year 06 in each of those locations.
Yeah. If I might, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would just note that Craig, Wrangell, Dillingham, Onalaska, Bethel, I mean, there's a substantial number of convictions there, 13, 42, 24, 67, and perhaps both are mine and Senator French's goal could be achieved if there was a population cutoff. You know, a village less than 100 could possibly be exempt, but a community the size of Bethel, I don't think should be exempt there. I mean, whether there are 5,000-6,000 people there.
If I just add in there, pardon me, to the chair, Senator Bundy. Some of those, though, like the Bethel convictions, would include the communities that surround Bethel as well that don't have courts that are served by the court in Bethel. So some of those convictions, unlike I believe the information from the Division of Motor Vehicles, it breaks down more accurately where the arrest was made. We only can count the locations where we have a court location. So the Bethel numbers would include some of the villages around Bethel as well as the community itself.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I point out that in that case, that's only 52 instead of 67 people. But again, substantial number, and the community of Bethel should have the same protection as community of Anchorage, or the citizens who are being responsible. So I guess, again, I would make the point that, and I don't have the magic number, but the smaller populations, I understand if there's someone's going to have to wait there 3 years before there's another DWI so that they could then get their multiple interlocking devices. But surely in a community the size of Bethel or Kotzebue or Dillingham, the citizen should have the same protection.
Senator French.
And I agree, especially with the examples you've given, Senator Bundy. You know, Dillingham, Bethel, those are both communities that I would expect would generate enough DWIs to easily support this idea. It's truly when you get out to the tiny little places that it just seems to be out of reach. And I guess I just want to overlay one more idea on the one you're discussing, which is a population cutoff. We wouldn't want to eliminate tiny towns that are on the road system, Coldfoot, Paxson, places like that that may only get one DWI per year, but you can hop in your car and drive to Fairbanks or drive to someplace else where you can find a commercially available IID. So I hope they'll overlay the transportation system, the highway system, on a population grid and come up with those tiny little isolated places where it's just out of reach.
Okay, further discussion, further questions for Mr. Wooliver? Okay, we do have three folks online just for questions. So just for the committee's edification, if you'd like to ask questions, Babette Miller is back on with Smart Start, the interlocking device company. Rodney Dial is on, I think it's Lieutenant Dial, with the Troopers. Dwayne Bannock and Carrie Hennings with the Division of Motor Vehicles. Any questions for any of those folks from the committee? Senator Bundy?
No. Question.
Anybody here in the audience that did not testify before that wishes to? Anybody online? Any of you folks that signed up for questions that wish to testify, add to your testimony? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed again. We had just the bill before us, correct? And we were discussing the waiver. So procedurally, where are we? I think it's just
a question.
Yeah, Senator Green.
On page one, line nine, that new language there, why is that necessary? What does that actually? It means a municipality must.
The idea of Senator Green through the chair is to get every municipality, if you will, in line so that when Anchorage enforces its DWI laws, when Fairbanks enforces its DWI laws, it doesn't sort of circumvent this whole requirement by not forcing ignition interlocks on their DWI convictees. A lot of the DWI prosecution that happens in Anchorage happens through the municipal prosecutor's right. office under Anchorage municipal ordinance and not through state law. And I've spoken to the mayor's office. They're in support of this measure, at least as far as Anchorage goes, because they want uniformity, and they don't want, you know, one DWI person to not have it and a state convicted person to be required.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I guess just on the record, I'd like to just put out there, and I don't know if we should, letters of intent, I don't know if they get lost in the shuffle, but it would be nice, Senator French, to see next year, for example, what the department determines, what lists they come up with that they determine where ignition interlock devices are unavailable. I think that'd be interesting for us to see.
And I think it's a fair question, fair requirement. It maybe as the bill works its way through the committee, we can get at least a draft from the department so they can tell us at least the long, give us an idea of what lines along which they're thinking.
Yeah.
I didn't butcher that sentence.
Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, I don't know. Procedurally, I had offered a conceptual amendment. I just to clean up things, I would withdraw that amendment, but
that's right.
But provide another conceptual amendment.
Okay.
Or amend the conceptual amendment, whatever it
so
is.
So that was amendment one, right? So let's withdraw that and just do a clean amendment two.
Thank you. And just conceptually possible we could finish this today if we move it to the bottom of the pile, perhaps. But Senator French makes some good points, and I absolutely agree with him. I'm wondering, I'm concerned about giving too much or not a lack of direction to the people that would administer this. And if we could put something in there that they could exempt under judgment based on off the road, population size, and volume of DWIs. And so even if all of a sudden you've got a small place and they start having an epidemic, they could then say, okay, you guys are no longer exempt. Two questions that have to be answered is, what would the population size cut off? Or do we have to specify that or just say, due to limited population and limited volume.
Senator French.
I just jotted down three factors, and I think they're all good. Thank you, Senator Bundy. And it may be that we can draft a conceptual amendment and firm it up in the next committee since we've got two more to go through. But the factors that we would ask the department to consider would be the volume of DWIs, the population size of the community in which the crime occurred, and three, the proximity of that community to a larger population through a road system or through a connected road. Mm-hmm. Because you may have, like Paxson, I just wouldn't want to exempt Paxson, even though it's tiny and few DWIs, because you can drive to a large population center. Whereas, a slightly small, a larger community that's totally isolated may have to be exempt.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Bundy, do you want to offer the conceptual amendment now? Let's take a brief at ease. For two, which we haven't conceived yet. Senator Bundy. Senator Stevens.
My question is, and maybe Senator French can answer this. I'm sort of struggling with it, that this is not necessarily a a violation with a geographical limit, because you may have a villager from a small community, but they also may go to Anchorage and be driving around. So you're just saying it's location, 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 and that's not really crucial, is it? I mean, it is important, but it's also important to realize that you could have DWI in a small community off the road system where you're only one, but you may also decide to drive in Anchorage, and you don't want that person driving in Anchorage either, do you?
It's through the chair, Senator Stevens. Actually, I guess we're just talking to each other, but I think that is a great point. You know, and as you were forming your question, I was thinking about someone who's a villager arrested in Anchorage for DWI that goes back to the village. You know, what to do with that person? What to do with a person who's a villager arrested in the village who later moves to Anchorage? Is he suddenly absolved of his ignition interlock requirement because of that transfer? And I think those are both valid points. You don't want to exempt people. Now we are sort of, now you're really truly in that. I think that you're in a very thin, very few offenders to whom this is going to apply. Nevertheless, people should be treated equally in as much as we can
do. Is there anyone here from DPS? Not this one.
Mr. Dial?
Oh yeah. Is it Lieutenant?
I think it's
Lieutenant Dial? Are you are you still online, or have you?
I am online.
Okay, wonderful. Are you following the discussion?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you have any advice for the committee? We're trying to decide on page 2, lines 16 through 18. Senator Bundy is, looking at a conceptual amendment that would kind of give some direction to the department about how you would determine whether an interlock device was unavailable, or putting some parameters around there. What are your thoughts?
For the record, my name is Rodney Dial, Alaska State Troopers. The only thought that went through my mind as you were having that discussion was I thought it might be important to point out that my belief is that there'd be a higher percentage of DUI convictions in the small remote communities that are a result of a serious injury or fatal collision of some sort, a snow machine, or car, because we need to keep in mind that most of these small communities have very little, or if any, traffic enforcement. So that might play a part in whether or not there is more of a safety concern by having an ignition interlock. I don't know. But some of those vehicles obviously are going to be such that you couldn't put a ignition interlock on them anyway, snow machines or ATVs, those type of things. I certainly agree that communities connected to the road system should not be exempt. I think that there are opportunities to get tech out to those communities and install these. That's probably the limit of my thoughts on this. I'd be available to answer any questions anybody might have.
So if you were looking, obviously this would come through. If it were left the way it were today without a conceptual amendment, then we would be leaving it up to the department to determine through by regulation how you would make that decision about unavailability. And so your statement on the record is that certainly if you're on the road system, you would. What about the other factors we discussed, such as population size, and what were the, there was
volume
one, and volume of DUIs. Any thoughts on those two?
Volume of DUIs, that seems reasonable. We also might want to consider that many communities, small communities, are exempt from insurance requirements. Perhaps the same criteria that's used to determine whether or not a community is required to have motor vehicle insurance, maybe that same criteria could be used for ignition interlocks.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
I think, just to help the committee along, I've got a couple of ideas on this. We can hold the bill over to Thursday. I can come back with some language, and that way we're not passing the bill out while the committee members still have questions about
it. I love it. Okay.
How it's going to work out.
So, Senator Bundy, would you be willing to, I'm not sure you had actually stated your conceptual amendment, but you're getting there.
It's in gestation period right now.
Yes.
Madam Chair, certainly withdraw my proposed amendment with and appreciative of Senator French's efforts to solidify and clarify. Trooper did say something that really resonated with me, and that is if someone was involved in a DWI, whatever the vehicle, that involved a serious injury or death. And that might be another factor that we would want the administration to, or whoever administers this, to take into consideration. Now, you're not going to get an interlock on a snow machine, but it's another factor that maybe someone would, hey, I don't want to lose my driver's license, so even though I'm not going to get an interlock on my snow machine, if I drive my snow machine drunk, I could lose my driver's license, which is valuable for that person in other arenas, coming to Anchorage, for instance.
Okay, so I think, thank you, Senator French, because I think once you get this worked out, and you could bring it in the form of a CS if you wanted, that we could just adopt. Because I think once we get this part ironed out, obviously the next committee is judiciary, which we're on. So I think it could sail smoothly through. But I think this is one of those things we've been struggling to get our arms around. So with your indulgence, we could bring it up first of the meeting on Thursday.
That's okay. Fine with me. Thank you.
And if you wanted, then work with my staff. She can order Shalon can order a CS, and we could do it that way. And make it easier. Okay, so we will set Senate Bill number 92 aside until Thursday's meeting, top of the hour. And we're just going to bring up next, Marit. This will be just our first hearing on this bill today, and we'll bring it up again Thursday as well. This is Marit from my office.
Hey, good morning.
Tell us about
committee
gift
members. For the record, my name is Marit Carlson Van Dort. I'm staff to Senator McGuire, and I'm here this morning to speak on Senate Bill 115, which is an act relating to gift cards. This bill is brought before the committee in response to a dramatic increase in consumer demand for more convenient gift options, and also consumer frustration with hidden or poorly disclosed fees and restrictions. In the past few years, there's been several states that have addressed these consumer concerns and have adopted measures to limit or restrict expiration dates and fees associated with these gift cards. Senate Bill 115 will include electronic gift cards, similar to credit or debit cards, as well as the more traditional paper gift certificates that are issued by businesses. This bill will ensure that gift cards that are purchased will retain their full purchased value in perpetuity and will not be subjected to expiration dates, dormancy fees, latency fees, administrative fees, periodic fees, service fees, or any other fee that will have the effect of reducing the total amount for which the holder may redeem the card. There are several exclusions. Gift cards that are issued under awards or loyalty or promotional programs are exempted. If they are donated to a nonprofit or a charitable organization, they're exempted. Or if it's a card that can be used to purchase goods or services at multiple locations, and also bank-issued gift cards. Gift cards issued in the ordinary course of an issuer's business that remain unclaimed by the owner for more than 3 years is presumed abandoned and will be subject to reporting to the State of Alaska Department of Revenue as unclaimed property. So that's what I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
And we do. And just before I get to you, Senator Bunny, we do have Rachel Lewis online. She's with the Department of Revenue in the Division of Unclaimed Property, and she's online to answer questions. Senator, here. My apologies. I haven't met you, Ms. Lewis. My apologies. So she's in the room. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm interested to hear if we have anyone from the business side. I'm wondering, I was at an event last weekend, and there's a certificate for a $10 discount on any purchase over $50, but it was time limited. It said it must be redeemed by the 1st of April. Mm-hmm. Now, would this bill prevent people putting a time limit up on things? And so it would be, they'd have to really basically carry down their books as a potential debit and up to 3 years, and then it would be considered abandoned?
Yes. And then they would report it to the state.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding, Mara, too, we discussed this earlier, is that promotions, and that's why we say awards, mm-hmm. promotions, and those types of things are specifically exempted from the bill. So what we're talking about are the gift cards. If I were to give Senator Green a gift certificate for Borders Books or Nordstrom or something like this, that she would know that she didn't have to rush out and use it in that year, that it would retain its value. And the complaint that has come back from consumers is that, you know, if it's a, it just kind of depends on where it would be. But let's say it is Nordstrom or something, and you don't feel like using it that year, but you want to use it the next. You go in and you find out that you have a lot less value on it than what you did before. So the 3 years seems to be kind of a reasonable time period, but it's not your $10 off if you use it by dates. It doesn't cover those, your awards, your promotions, those kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
It's the gift cards that there's actual money exchanged for. Senator Stevens.
I was just wondering, through the chair, do you have any statistics on how much is unclaimed? I mean, I seem to remember having read something in the newspaper that there's an enormous amount of money out there that merchants are getting a benefit of the money that people have given them, and much of that is never used. So it seems to me that it's a great benefit to the merchant if someone is given $100 and that person never uses it. So any idea on the amount of money we're talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think Rachel Lewis could speak to that. Trace that for a second. Yeah.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Rachel Lewis. I work for the Department of Revenue. I'm the Unclaimed Property Administrator for the state. In response to your question through the chair, approximately $58 billion was sold in gift cards last year. The estimate is $8 billion will not be redeemed. Some companies are reporting those as unclaimed property. Some are rolling those into income, and this bill is to help eliminate that and really define that money belongs to the consumers who have purchased those gift cards.
Senator Bundy.
You said billion with a B. Is that just for Alaska, or that must be nationwide?
Through the chair. Senator Bundy, that is nationwide, and it is continuing to grow every year.
And I assume we don't have stats for Alaska, or you would have given them.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I can tell you what has been reported to the state of Alaska in gift cards. We have approximately, $58,000, 1,007 people. Gift cards are just pretty new within the last 5 years. It's really been snowballing, so a lot of companies are just getting their books set up to really monitor their usage and that kind of thing. So I don't have figures of what could happen in the future, but I definitely know that Alaskans use a lot of electronic gift cards and gift certificates in their everyday life.
Senator Bundy?
Just so I understand, the 58,000 in the dollars and 1,000-some people, that was unclaimed, or that's the number of...
Through the chair, Senator DeBundy, that has what been turned over to the state of Alaska in the last year or two.
Senator Stevens.
Could you help me understand unclaimed property? I don't really understand that issue, but what happens with that money, that unclaimed property? Does the state get anything out of that? Can we cash in the Barnes & Noble credit card? How does that work? Is there any value to the state to unclaimed property?
Senator Stevens, through the chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to give you a little information about unclaimed property.
Yeah.
Since 1986, we've had about $88 million worth of unclaimed property turned over to the state. That includes uncashed payroll checks, uncashed insurance reimbursements, old bank accounts, stocks, mutual funds, dividend reinvestment plans. About $23 million has been returned to owners in Alaska or who had resided in Alaska. During the last 21 years, what we believe is not going to be claimed in a year, we do put into the general fund and is used for all Alaskans. and that dollar amount is about $58 million since 1986. On average, right now, we are usually transferring $3 to $9 million. It just depends. Each year, new companies are coming into compliance, and they'll go back and reach back in their records for 10 years, and we may get $800,000. And then the next year, we might only get an average of maybe 15 or 40 or something like that.
Senator Steve?
Just to follow up, I guess I don't really still understand how it works. I mean, if I have a gift certificate from, say, a bookstore or a restaurant, and I don't claim it, and it eventually becomes unclaimed property, how does the state get its value out of that? How do you get the money from Barnes & Noble or Walmart or do you?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. Every year, every company reviews their books for any outstanding liabilities that have certain dormancy periods, and it would be the three-year dormancy period, and they file an unclaimed property report with the state of Alaska if the last known address of the recipient is in the state of Alaska. If it is not and they can't determine that, then it would go to the state of incorporation of the business holding the money as unclaimed property.
And that letter comes with a check.
Yes. Okay. Senator French.
I need to go back to the beginning because I must have missed something. The Section 4 says that a person may not sell or offer to sell a gift card unless the gift card is redeemable at full face value in perpetuity, right? Forever and ever. This is what the gift card is worth. And yet back at Section 1, we say that a gift card that's issued that remains unclaimed is for more than 3 years is presumed abandoned. I don't get it. If I keep that gift card in my wallet for 3 years and don't use it, is it abandoned or is it good in perpetuity?
Through the chair, it's both. It's good in perpetuity with the state of Alaska. The business it removes it from their liability account after 3 years, but the gift card is still good if it's been reported to the state of Alaska, and you can redeem. You can claim your money through the state of Alaska unclaimed property office.
And so I, because I'm terrible about this. I've got, you know, and my family just seems to collect these things. We keep them in one little drawer of my organizer.
No.
And, you know, once a year you pull them out and go, oh, my goodness, someone gave us this, you know, 2 years ago. We never used it. We need to go to this restaurant or we need to go to that hotel. And so I go to the hotel and they say, sorry, this is only has a 2 year, you know, it's only good for 2 years or, how would I then know that I can get my money back from the state? Would they have to tell me? Would I have to know about this on my own? I mean, if this is, you see my question?
Mm-hmm.
If they won't honor it, how do I figure out that it's actually good in perpetuity, which is what we're saying here in Section 4?
Through the chair, Senator French, I'm not really sure what they have on here. It's stated on the card on some of these details. Mm-hmm. That's the unfair trade practices portion of it, and I'm not as familiar with that as I am with the unclaimed mm-hmm. property portion of it. But in response to having a gift card that expires in 1 year or 2 years, and you go to a business and present that gift card, they have two choices. They can go ahead and honor that gift card and just go ahead and extend their 1 year expiration date, which we often find businesses prefer to do. Or they will refer you to the state of Alaska if that is where they've turned over their money or to whatever state that they've turned over that money to.
Heath Hilliard is here and has done some work on the other body's version of this bill. You want to come up? I know it's complex. You know, it's an attempt at trying to address an issue that a lot of consumers in Alaska have been complaining about because we, and I think it's maybe because of the geographical we have a high amount of folks that buy gift cards, or maybe it's just because we're lazy shoppers. I don't know. Don't feel like picking something out, so we get the gift card. But folks show up, and much to their disappointment, they've lost a great amount of value of that gift card. And if you really think about it, if I walk into the store at REI, for example, and I'm going to buy you a jacket, whether I buy a gift card in that amount or buy you the actual jacket ought to be kind of the same idea. I mean, it's money into their coffers that wouldn't otherwise be there. And what you're seeing companies do is kind of come back and double dip. And so we're trying to give, this is a consumer protection bill. We're trying to give to maximize the benefit to the consumer, not in any way that's unfair to a business, in a way that is completely fair. The business has received the benefit of that purchase, and now we just want the consumer to have a little bit more fairness in the process. So, Heath, did you want to respond to that last?
For the record, Heath Hilliard, staff Representative Gatto, and Representative Gatto is the House sponsor of this bill, the House version, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer some information to the committee. Through the chair, Senator French, that same question came before the House Labor and Commerce Committee in their deliberations on the House version. And I believe Ms. Lewis did a good job explaining sort of how unclaimed properties worked. Our original version that we were considering actually had an expiration period of 7 years.
Yeah.
And that was because the version that we worked on the House originally was modeled after Massachusetts, and they had a 7-year expiration period. Through the course of the deliberations in Labor and Commerce Committee in the House, we opted to go with in perpetuity, actually at the request of one of the co-prime sponsors, and the Representative Gatto, the prime sponsor, had no objection to that. So first of all, the in perpetuity was somewhat arbitrary, if you will. However, in keeping with the desire to maximize consumer protection in the state, we thought it was reasonable. And as Ms. Lewis explained, my understanding is that device will forever hold its value, and you may actually be physically in possession of it, and it's considered unclaimed or abandoned, and then it's up to the retailer, the business who issued it, to determine how they want to handle it. For instance, I know that Representative Ramris, in the course of his discussion, indicated, well, the gift cards, gift certificates at my businesses are valuable. You know, they retain their value. I never write them off. I would want people to come back. So as a business owner, I don't particularly, I have no problem with that. The decision at that 3-year mark is, now they've reported it to the state of Alaska's Unclaimed Property Division. When that customer comes back in and presents it, it's then the business's option to say, yeah, okay, we'll value that. We'll honor that. And we'll report back to the state of Alaska that this value has been claimed back, or we're going to send you off to the Unclaimed Properties Division, and you can go and get your value that way. And that's my understanding is that it's the retailer's option to make a decision how they would want to handle that. And like I said, my understanding, the sort of anecdotal evidence is that many retailers in the state will continue to honor that. It's just sort of, what do you do with this lingering balance on your books? In defense of many businesses, both large and small, local and national, we have found in the course of our investigation on the House version that many retailers in the state do continue to value their gift cards or you know, honor them indefinitely. Some do not. In truth, and I certainly can't speak to the sponsor's intent here. Our intent originally for the House version was actually to get at what are called open universe cards that are now specifically exempted. The main reason, the open universe cards, they're essentially credit logo cards, and what it is you, Simon Malls, Wells Fargo, KeyBank all issue these types of cards, and what they do is they essentially open a temporary bank account.
Yeah.
The problem is those are all regulated by federal banking laws, and so as a result, the main offenders that we really wanted to address, we can't. However, in the course of our research, we did find that there are definitely some larger retailers in the state that still are kind of abusive, and at least the House sponsor's intent was to really maximize consumer protection. So, long and convoluted, but hopefully I answered some of your questions.
And Senator French, just to add to that, this committee could make a decision, and that's why I'm going to hold it over till Thursday, to make whatever termination point we wanted. If we wanted to do the Massachusetts model and say 7 years, we could do that. If we wanted to keep it the way it is in perpetuity and go through the unclaimed property statutes, we could do that. Most states are dealing with this somehow, and how you choose to do it is up to you. But again, the goal was to think about you know, the maximum value to that consumer that you could give with respect to the limitations of some of the federal laws that supersede our authority here. Senator French and then Senator Bundy.
Even I clean out my cubbyhole every couple of years, so I wouldn't have any problem going in 7 years. That just seems like maybe a reasonable amount of time.
We talked about that this
morning. But I guess what I'm trying to collapse is the difference between Section 1 and Section 4. I guess I'd like to see them set the same, and maybe I'm missing some important policy distinction, but it just strikes me that we're saying to the consumer, these cards are good for 7 years. You don't have to worry about them anymore. They're full value for 7 years. But you could easily walk in there to Barnes & Noble or to a restaurant where you've paid for a gift card after 3 years, and they say, oh, no, we wrote that off a year ago. And maybe the server and the manager knows how to, what to tell you about what to do with your money, but maybe they don't. And so I'm concerned that we're setting folks up for long, dusty cubbyhole periods followed by disappointment.
That's right.
Through the chair, I just would offer, Senator French, if you made the expiration period the same as the unclaimed property, then that would negate the need for unclaimed property in these devices. Because if you say it's 3 years expiration and it happens to become unclaimed property at 3 years, then there'd be no unclaimed property because then it would cease to have value.
We talked about that. So this morning, the two approaches we discussed were make it commensurate with the unclaimed property statute already on the books. So that would be 3 years. Eliminate it, and they'd be the same. Go to the Massachusetts model, which is 7 years, or keep with perpetuity and then have the distinctions. But I don't disagree, Senator French, that it might cause consumer confusion. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Your analogy of buying the jacket is resonating with me. I buy the jacket. They don't charge me an activation fee for the jacket, and they don't charge me if I don't use my jacket every month.
That's right.
So there is some double dipping in there, as I think the term you used, I understand what you're focused at, and I certainly endorse that. I'm just wondering about some of the practicalities. Someone gives me a $100 gift certificate to Barnes & Noble, and 3 years later I realize I haven't used that. I go to Barnes & Noble, and they choose not to honor it. How much paperwork, how much cost to the state will it be for that person then to come and say, okay, I want my remaining $37.50 that was on that card back? I'm wondering, we, the state, have the use of the money for until that person comes and claims. Is that generate enough interest to pay for the expense of
having
an unclaimed property person have to go through, judge this as an accurate claim, and then write a check? Does your division make money, or does it cost money?
Through the chair, I would say we are very automated with claims processing, and gift cards is a very small portion of the processing, and we have an online system for claims processing, so I do not think it would cost the state very much money.
Senator Bundy? I think we're making money. I think that's what the figure was there, 58 million?
Yeah.
Money
since
that we
86.
Didn't have before, since 86, so.
Okay, thank you.
So there is some merit to it. So further questions? Okay, and there's anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Anyone online? Okay, Senator Bundy?
And just as you, a question for you,
yeah.
Madam Chair. As you went through this process, are any of these companies that are now doing gift cards contacted you and said, well, we're not going to do them anymore if you do this, or this isn't burdensome, or obviously they're doing it because they it generates business, and if it's a burden, they'll stop doing it. But particularly those that are the double dippers now, has anyone contacted you and protested this legislation?
No, Senator Bunny, no one has. And kind of my position on it is, again, back to the jacket issue, choose to do it or don't, if you think it generates income, I think by and large, whatever the terms are, just make them clear. And I think merchants in Alaska will choose to keep the gift card system because I think they're so popular. And I still think they'll get the benefit of having those customers come in. But I haven't had anybody contact me in contrary to it. Any opposition?
Yeah. And just the observation, if I'm running a business and I can sell a few business cards, I get the money up front. I get the use of the money and make money on the float there until I have to.
Yep.
And I'm sure there are those that plan on a certain percentage won't ever redeem the whole card.
Yep.
And so it is a, it is clever business.
It's very. It's clever, but it's also convenient for us. So I think there's a trade-off for the lazy shoppers that we are.
I have a couple of questions.
Yes, Senator Green.
I know at Christmas we bought some for the kids, and there was an upfront fee with the card. It was, say, it was $100, and it was $103.50 or $106. Does this address that?
Yeah, it wouldn't allow it.
Wouldn't allow it, okay. Okay, and the other thing is, and I notice you have, you still refer to gift certificates on line 5, page 1, and yet you're taking certificate out. Is certificate addressed somewhere else in statute, or are you going to just remove the certificate from this provision?
Mart, you want to speak to that? I think we intended to remove it.
Through the chair, Senator Green, it was intended to be removed, and I think that it is defined somewhere, and gift certificates are included under the definition of gift card.
That's what it is, yep. So on page 3, at the bottom, lines 29.
Yes.
Through 31. Means a device that's usable up to its face amount instead of cash in exchange for goods or services except telephone services. So we're changing the definition and including it. So it's all encompassing.
Well, I would say it's confusing. I know
okay.
What I think a gift card is. It's not a gift certificate.
Okay. Does the House version, Heath, have certificate redefined in this way? You'd rather have both, is your point. Give a certificate or a card.
Madam Chair, again, Heath Hillard, Staff Representative Gatto. Our version opted for gift card, and that was a drafting function. Mm-hmm. Ms. Bannister, who's the drafter on the House version, and I believe the same on the on the Senate version, we went for a more generic term that broadly includes gift certificate as it currently exists, but now we also include gift card because it's a specific type of device. And above that, on lines 26 through 28, there's also a specific definition for device as well. So,
Senator French.
Just for the record, I shared Senator Green's concern. A gift card, I think of as a little plastic thing that goes in my wallet, but you get lots and lots of those nice little paper gift certificates, and I just don't know if the average consumer would realize that they're now under the same rules as the gift card, which is what we're focusing on in the bill. I noticed the title says an act relating to gift certificates and gift cards, and I'm sure the drafters would hate to have us put gift card or gift certificate throughout, but it would be clearer, at least my surface analysis is that it would be clearer for consumers if we refer to them both.
Well, let's have we'll have Ms. Bannister here on Thursday to answer that question about why, and it I think it's just what Mr. Hilliard said. It's a drafting choice to make it all-encompassing. You can see that it's in the definition section, but I don't disagree that as a consumer you tend to think of the paper certificate and the card as more something that looks like a credit card. So when we come back on Thursday, then we'll be addressing, at least right now, the issue of expiration, definition of certificate, and Senator Stevens.
I just want to point out, if anybody from APOC is listening, you've mentioned twice giving committee members gifts, and you haven't done that at all.
That's right. I gave you a jacket and you a Nordstrom card. And,
And more's the pity. Right?
I know. Okay, so we'll go ahead and set that aside. So that brings us to HCR 3 by Representative Meyer. And we have Suzanne. Still Cunningham.
6 months.
Yes. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff of Representative Meyer. Representative Meyer apologizes for not being here this morning. They are putting the finishing touches on what will appear this afternoon in the Finance Committee, the operating budget. So it's a privilege to be before you today to discuss HCR 3, which proclaims April 2007 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Sexual assault is a difficult issue to discuss. However, given the status of this crime in Alaska, it deserves to be at the forefront of discussion on public safety and health concerns. HCR 3 acknowledges the problem of sexual assault in Alaska and the need for greater awareness, prevention, and education. By observing this month, schools, state agencies, local partnerships, and individuals are encouraged to seek out or sponsor activities that educate and work to increase the public awareness of sexual assault in our state. The statistics relating to these crimes do provide a pretty sobering reality to all Alaskans. Sexual assault is one of the most violent crimes and underreported crimes in our state. Our forcible rape rate is 2.5 times higher than the national average. Alaska has 6 times the national average of reported child sexual assault. And these are just statistics that were garnered through reports made to law enforcement and child protection services. In 2006, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault conducted a public opinion and public awareness survey on domestic violence and sexual assault in Alaska. 75% of Alaskans polled have experienced or know someone who has experienced domestic violence or sexual assault. Over the course of the past few years, the legislature has made a great effort to increase the penalties for sexual assault offenders and to make our laws tougher. We also need to encourage and work together with service providers and agencies in our state to increase awareness and education on this issue, as well as services that are available for victims and their loved ones. HCR 3 seeks to support sexual assault survivors and their loved ones who are also impacted by these crimes. It shows support for the countless organizations and individuals who dedicate their lives to assisting victims of sexual assault, educating Alaska on these crimes, and advocating for increased public safety and victims' rights. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm available for questions, and Representative Meyer appreciates the consideration of the committee today.
Thank you very much. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Madam Chair, many in the legislature worked last year very hard on a sexual assault revision to our laws. And I had a reporter call me earlier this year. Apparently, the Judicial Council had come out with some data saying the recidivism rate on sexual assault is way down. And I think the assumption then, or the unspoken message was, well, why are you getting so tough on sex crimes? Because there's just not that much recidivism. Intuitively, I rejected that comment because of the data on how underreported the crime is. But are you aware of that report? And did you or Representative Myers have a reaction to it?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we are aware of the report. And I think in my packet of information, I actually have the Anchorage Daily News article that was written on it. And Representative Meyer has worked on sexual assault laws since he became a member of the State House of Representatives. He served as a board member on Standing Together Against Rape. Mm-hmm. And while I don't certainly speak for him right now, he is pretty certain that just one crime is enough. It's not a recidivism matter. While recidivism is of great concern, interpersonal violence is devastating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Cunningham? Okay, we have, thank you. We have 3 people in the audience just for questions only. Chris Ashenbrenner, Peg Brown, and Karen Robinson. Did any of you change your mind? Okay, come on up. You all said questions only, but sometimes I know testimony makes you change your mind. So go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah. I am Chris Ashenbrenner, and I'm the interim program administrator for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And through the chair, I'd like to speak to Senator Bundy's question on the report out of Anchorage. And I haven't read the whole report, but I would paraphrase what Representative Faircloth said in response to that report, which is my knowledge from working in the field as well, is that sex offenders do get smarter after they're caught, for one. And the other thing I know about that report is it only looked back 4 years, and that's a pretty short time. And the third thought that comes to me when this comes up is a conversation I had with a woman who had been sexually assaulted in a village. And she reported it through actually the sexual assault program that had been out, the educator, and she disclosed at that time. And she told me later that it so disrupted the family. She was so censured for reporting. People were mad at her in her town. Her family was mad at her. She felt like her aunt had lost her financial support when her uncle went to jail. That when he came back to her town and started offending her again, she never told. And so that answers a statistical data report with a story. But I wanted to get up and tell you that story because whenever I hear that, that's the story I think about. So in addition, I thank you in advance for supporting this resolution. I think it's the key to getting these statistics down and getting these rates down and getting these personal horrible offenses down is awareness. We have to get out into those schools. We have to talk to the children. We have to talk to the communities to get to the point where when that child in that community tells that her uncle is raping her, there isn't a person in that community that doesn't censure that behavior.
Absolutely.
So this resolution is part of the whole puzzle and putting the pieces together to get there. So thanks.
Absolutely.
And
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Well said. Okay. What is the will of the committee? Can I have a motion?
Yes, I'll move, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens. Okay. Any objection to the motion to move House Concurrent Resolution number 3 out of this committee? Okay. Hearing none, so moved. And we're adjourned.